Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 1. First, some preliminary observations on the play. Theology. In Christian terms, revenge amounts to usurpation of God's prerogatives. But this understanding clashes with what we find in classical literature. In Aeschylus's trilogy, The Oresteia, Orestes would be wrong not to take vengeance for Agamemnon's murder. The Elizabethans loved Senecan revenge tragedy, as Thomas Kyd's The Spanish Tragedy shows, but in Hamlet, Shakespeare faces squarely the revenger's theological dilemma. It should be noted that in The Spanish Tragedy, Kyd by no means ignores this Christian versus pagan dilemma. It's just that in Hamlet, Shakespeare intensifies its importance. Skepticism. There is something to the idea that Hamlet is not fit to be a tragic hero. C.T.S. Eliot's Hamlet and His Problems, for example. We can say only half in jest that Hamlet's problem is he's read too many of Montaigne's skeptical essays. Early in the play, all the prince has to go on is that a ghost tells him what he wants to hear. Uncle Claudius is stealing Gertrude's attention and her son's kingdom. Recognition. When does Hamlet attain clarity about the nature of his actions? He has come round to the idea that he needs to let things shape up as they may, assuming that he's in earnest and not deceiving himself, when he makes his remarks about, quote-unquote, a special providence in the fall of a sparrow, and so forth. How did he get to that point? Perhaps Hamlet's realization is due to facing the shock of Ophelia's death, meditating on an army going to its death, quote-unquote, even for an eggshell, bantering with a gravedigger, meditating on Yorick's skull, escaping from the ship that's taking him to England, being ransomed by pirates, experiencing conflicted feelings about Ophelia and Gertrude, being a young man with his whole life ahead of him and yet compelled to give his life for his dead father's honor. In the Poetics, Aristotle says that well-crafted tragedies turn upon the heroes arriving at some insight. In Greek, that's anagnorisis, recognition, about his or her mistake. What is Hamlet's insight, and what has led him to it? What makes the play's resolution possible? That Hamlet has been unable to act and something now makes him able? Or should we account for the resolution differently? Proto-romantic subjectivity. Harold Bloom wrote that Hamlet, thanks to his intense interiority and complexity, overflows the revenge tragedy that hosts him. Bloom's notion resembles the Romantic era conception of the Prince of Denmark as a man, quote-unquote, out of joint with and superior to the action hero task handed to him by his father's ghost. That isn't the only way we can interpret Hamlet as a character, but it is a compelling reading. Act 1. This spirit, dumb to us, will speak to him. A ghost who perfectly resembles Hamlet's dead father appears to Marcellus and Barnardo, as well as to Hamlet's skeptical friend Horatio. In Act 1, Scene 1, Barnardo and Francisco await the changing of their watch at Elsinore Castle, and Marcellus shows up. Marcellus and Barnardo have seen a strange apparition twice, and Marcellus has invited Hamlet's friend Horatio to watch with them tonight. Horatio remains dubious and, quote-unquote, will not let belief take hold of him. Act 1, Scene 1, line 23. A third sighting materializes, looking just like the late King Hamlet Sr. Even Horatio is a believer now, though the ghost has nothing to say to him. The ghost was dressed in full battle armor, so Horatio offers a plausible conjecture. He suspects the apparition's presence, quote-unquote, bodes some strange eruption to our state. Act 1, Scene 1, line 68, meaning that the ghost intends to issue a security warning. After all, young Fortinbras is planning to take back territory his father had lost to Hamlet Sr. Barnardo supposes much the same, quote unquote, "Well may it sort that this portentous figure comes armed through our watch, so like the king that was and is the question of these wars." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 108 through 110. Still, these men's plausible surmises do not address the ghost's real purpose. Horatio wants Hamlet to engage with the ghost and gain particular, intimate knowledge of its purpose. As Horatio says, quote unquote, "This spirit, dumb to us, will speak to him." Act 1, Scene 1, line 170. "'Tis common, all that lives must die. The new king Claudius and his queen Gertrude hold court and try to cheer up the brooding Prince Hamlet, who still mourns for his father, King Hamlet." In Act 1, Scene 2, the new king, Claudius, has married his sister-in-law Gertrude after the death of his brother, King Hamlet Sr. Claudius is a smooth, skillful speaker, but betrays a schizoid sense of his actions. He has married Gertrude, quote-unquote, "our sometime sister, now our queen," quote-unquote, "with a defeated joy," and, quote-unquote, "with an auspicious and a dropping eye." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 10 through 11. Claudius sends Cornelius and Voltimand to Old Norway, uncle of young Fortinbras, and assents to Polonius's request that his son Laertes be allowed to return to France. The king then rounds on Hamlet and asks, quote unquote, "How is it that the clouds still hang on you?" Act 1, Scene 2, line 66. Hamlet's grief seems to the royal couple impolitic, self-indulgent, and prideful. Gertrude says to Hamlet, quote unquote, "Do not forever with thy veiled lids seek for thy noble father in the dust. Thou knowest 'tis common, all that lives must die." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 70 through 72. This is expected and probably even sound advice on the part of concerned medieval parents. What today we would consider premature death was all too common back then. But Hamlet's response already shows signs of the intense interiority that will cause him so much inner conflict later in the play. He tells his mother Gertrude, quote unquote, "I have that within which passes show, these but the trappings and the suits of woe." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 85 through 86. Soon, Hamlet speaks his first soliloquy, beginning, quote unquote, "Oh, that this too sallied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 129 through 130. He laments that God has already, quote unquote, "fixed his canon against self-slaughter." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 131 through 132. He also reproaches women in the person of Gertrude, quote unquote, "Frailty, thy name is woman." Act 1, Scene 2, line 146. In case that isn't reason enough for his depression, Hamlet reveals how much disdain he feels for his uncle Claudius, especially in comparison with Hamlet Sr. The latter, he says, was Hyperion to Claudius's, quote-unquote, satyr. Act 1, Scene 2, line 140. Hamlet morbidly sees the whole world as, quote-unquote, "an unweeded garden that grows to seed." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 135 through 136. A garden inhabited by, quote-unquote, "things rank and gross in nature." Act 1, Scene 2, line 136. He is already obsessed with the dark intimation that people are not what they seem. They never are, in truth, and that's particularly true in the treacherous, courtly environments Shakespeare so often portrays, as he does here in Denmark's Elsinore Castle. To borrow a line from Horatio, quote unquote, "There needs no ghost, my lord, come from the grave to tell us this." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 127 through 128. In any case, Hamlet knows he must repress this feeling in public. Quote unquote, "But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue." Act 1, Scene 2, line 159. Like others in this courtly environment, he has been brought up to understand that he is a public man, so to speak. Privately, he already suspects that, quote unquote, "some foul play was involved in his father's death." Act 1, Scene 2, line 255. The prince's scene-ending thought is, quote unquote, "foul deeds will rise, though all the earth o'erwhelm them to men's eyes." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 256 through 257. Hamlet is about to receive his orders as a revenger, and his response will be anything but simple. But his intimation that a supernatural framework is about to usurp his private griefs is not wrong. To thine own self be true. Polonius fills France-bound Laertes with advice on conduct and morals, while Laertes and Polonius both lecture Ophelia about Hamlet's intentions and royal status. In Act 1, Scene 3, Laertes lectures his sister Ophelia about the dangers of romancing a man above her station. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 10 through 49 inclusive. This advice is sound as far as it goes, though it's rather cheeky of Laertes to mansplain the importance of chastity to a sister who is at least as mature as he is. Ironically, Queen Gertrude, as she later admits, had hoped the two lovers would in fact marry. The difference in rank never bothered her at all. Ophelia wittily holds her own against Laertes, chiding him with, quote unquote, "Do not, as some ungracious pastors do, show me the steep and thorny way to heaven, whiles a puffed and reckless libertine himself the primrose path of dalliance treads." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 46 through 49. Polonius offers the departing Laertes some conduct book sounding advice, such as, quote unquote, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be," Act 1, Scene 3, line 74. But his best advice is, quote unquote, "This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 77 through 79. How ironic to hear such advice spoken in a play where so many noble characters find it hopelessly impolitic to heed. Of course, as authors such as Walter Raleigh and Francis Bacon could tell us, such advice often arises in precisely the kind of environment that renders it all but impossible to follow. Polonius ends the scene by accusing Ophelia of being naive about Hamlet's intentions. Hamlet is a young, lusty, royal bachelor, and is therefore not to be trusted. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 89 and following. The sum is, quote unquote, "I would not in plain terms, ellipsis, have you, ellipsis, talk with the Lord Hamlet." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 131 through 133. "Thou com'st in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee." The ghost beckons Hamlet to follow him, and he follows. In Act 1, Scene 4, Hamlet discusses the court of Denmark's fondness for alcohol, declaring that his country is, quote-unquote, "traduced and taxed of other nations for this weakness." Act 1, Scene 4, line 18. Hamlet is not certain what to think of the strange apparition that soon visits him when he joins the watchman and Horatio. Quote unquote, "What may this mean that thou dead corpse, again in complete steel, revisits thus the glimpses of the moon?" Act 1, Scene 4, lines 51 through 53. Still, he will follow the ghost and declares, quote unquote, "Thou comest in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I'll call thee Hamlet, King, Father, Royal Dane." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 43 through 45. "Thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain." Hamlet listens intently to the ghost's story and vows revenge. In Act 1, Scene 5, the ghost affirms that he is Hamlet's father and then recounts in detail what happened to him. Hamlet's excited, quote unquote, "Oh, my prophetic soul," suggests that he already suspected Claudius. Act 1, Scene 5, line 41. The terms the ghost uses resemble Hamlet's. Gertrude has married, quote unquote, "a wretch whose natural gifts were poor to those of mine." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 51 through 52. The revenge command is clear, quote unquote, "Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 82 through 83. Act 1, Scene 5, lines 82 through 83. But there is also the impossible demand, quote unquote, "Taint not thy mind, nor let thy soul contrive against thy mother aught." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 85 through 86. Since ancient times, for example in Homer's Odyssey and Aeschylus's Oresteia trilogy, there has been a strong sense of blood pollution adhering to the act of revenge, something that calls for the strongest possible purification rituals after it is accomplished. However that may be, Hamlet seems convinced, for now, to be his father's revenger. Or at least, that's how it seems. Near the beginning of the ghost's recounting, Hamlet proclaims that he wants his revenge to come on, quote unquote, "wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 29 through 31. But soon his metaphor shifts, quote unquote, "Yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records," ellipsis, "and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 98 through 99, and lines 102 through 103. Hamlet's scholarly metaphor is apt in that it invokes something like the schoolboy's fearful, diligent conning of his Latin lessons in grammar school. In Shakespeare's time, the arts of memorization were much promoted, which may account for all those Elizabethan actors with phenomenal ability to remember their lines under pressure. At the same time, the context in which Hamlet generates this metaphor renders it slightly comical in that he speaks of writing at the instant when he seems most certain of his desire to act. Revengers may be stymied for a time, but they don't need a note about a revenge date on their calendars. When Hamlet returns, he swears his friends to secrecy and says, quote unquote, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 168 through 169. He may need to, quote unquote, "put an antique disposition on," but apparently they are expected to understand that underlying motives and circumstances make this necessary. Act 1, Scene 5, line 173. Hamlet's concluding words are perhaps the most revealing ones in the second act. They indicate that the prince's meeting with his ghostly father have both won his acceptance of the task laid upon him and reinforced an already strong world-weariness. Quote unquote, "The time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that ever I was born to set it right." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 189 through 190. Do these words indicate indecisiveness or even resentment? It is hard to take Hamlet's utterance here as consonant with the initial desire to, quote-unquote, sweep to his revenge. From now on, Hamlet's alternating enthusiasm and lack of motivation will be a feature, not a bug. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Saturday, May 10th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.